Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I'm very lucky to be joined by Dr. Danny Sulikoski, who is an expert in evolutionary psychology and looks a lot at sort of female mating strategies and all that sort of stuff, which, of course, is going to be quite fascinating. So, Dr. Danny, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Very happy to be here.
I think I'll start with this. There is something that I've been pondering that, you know, perhaps individually makes sense, but when you put the thoughts together, makes less sense. And that is, if you ask the typical woman what she's looking for in society, you'll often get an answer something like, I want women to have the same status and earning as men. Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm. And then if you ask what a woman wants for herself individually, you'll often hear, well, I want a man who has more status and earnings than I do. And as long as you keep those thoughts disconnected, that's fine. But when you put them together, you've got a bit of a problem at the societal level. Do you think that observation is right? And what do you think that tells us? Is that a problem?
Yes, it's mostly right. And it's definitely a problem. I don't know how many women would consciously tell you that what they want is a man that earns more than they do or that has higher social status than they do. But we know that this necessarily is what women want, whether it's what they would say consciously or not. I think a lot of women probably would not say that consciously, much the same way people will often profess that looks don't matter. They find the person attractive. That's a lovely thing to say, but we know it's not true.
Yes.
I suspect that if you ask a lot of women, they probably wouldn't tell you that they want someone that is wealthier than them, but we know that they do. So the basic observation that what women profess to want in terms of societal gender equality does not marry well with women's mate choice preferences. It just doesn't. And that's obviously a problem. And it creates a whole bunch of flow-on effects, but one of those is the sort of perpetual singledom of a lot of professional career women who, because of their own earnings, social status, financial position, and because of their preferences, whether they're aware of them or not, for a man that is going to exceed that, they are really shrinking their prospective partner pool. And that makes it very difficult to find a partner that they're willing to accept.
Yes, and how does this get measured? Because, I mean, the other phenomena that I've seen, and you know, anecdotally on social media and stuff, is, you know, you'll have you know, somebody who works as a barista but has a liberal arts degree will be rejecting somebody who works as a plumber earning 4x as much as she does. So it's not even necessarily earnings. It's this status thing.
Yeah, that's right. Earnings and status tend to go together, but they don't always go together. And when they separate, status seems to be more important than earnings. So I'm trying to think if there's a specific study I can think of that has tried to separate those two out, and I can't think of one that has tried to actually put those two in direct competition with each other to tell you whether we have any formal data. But certainly informally, and my impression from, you know, the collective reading of the literature, is that status wins out over resources, primarily because status is an indicator of potential resources. So if you have resources but you don't have status, then you don't necessarily have the means to increase the resources that you have. If you have status but you don't have resources, you're potentially quite young and are yet to build up the wealth and the assets. But if you have the status, then you have the potential to do so. So certainly for younger women and, you know, partnering up with younger men who don't yet have a lifetime of wealth to show for their toils, status is very important because very few younger men actually have any accrued wealth. Some come from wealth. Obviously, there's obviously implications that come with familial wealth in terms of how much wealth a young person might have. But most young people just starting out in adulthood don't have wealth. And so status becomes the cue that women use to judge whether or not a man will acquire wealth by the time he's older, when they're making quite young mate choice decisions. So in the sort of, I guess, unusual circumstances where wealth and status become decoupled, if even though wealth is perhaps what women want, if you like, that's what is being sought, those access to those resources to support successful reproduction. But if the cue that we've been selected to rely upon is status, then it's going to trump wealth in the unusual situations where those two things become decoupled. Mm.
Okay, another thing, big thing that I've been thinking about is, I mean, I totally get that women are hypergamous and they seek, you know, better quality men. And I think from an evolutionary perspective, you must want that to be the case, because if women selected the lowest quality men, what that would do to the species over a period of time would be disastrous. So I completely get that that is a necessary function in all sexually selective species. So I get that. The issue is that 500 years ago, that meant selecting the best guy in the village that you could get hold of. With the dating app market, that means selecting the best guy from his best photos within 20 miles who might actually be asleep at the time that you're looking. And we've got this weird phenomenon with dating apps where, you know, 10% of the men are sharing disproportionately basically any of the women that they want. I mean, I know a guy, fabulously good looking, nice chap. He looks like he's been AI generated. And if you ask him about Tinder, he says, yeah, I completed it. You know, he went through something like 600 dates over the space of a 2-year period. And then just eventually one day decided, I'm bored of this. And he basically just settled down with the next one, which is random and funny. But that is how this sexual market works today. And women seem okay with this arrangement, which to my mind seems a bit odd. So what's going on there?
Okay, so a couple of things. First of all, I will pick you up that it's not about what's good for the species. So the way evolution works, it works on the currency of reproduction, and that's actually really important. So it can produce a social system, a mating system that can be ghastly by any, you know, by any moral evaluation. What will be selected for is what makes individuals reproduce at the level of the individual, regardless of what is then the sort of emergent social system that comes from all of these different individuals behaving the way they've been selected to behave. The system you get then emerges from that and then creates its own system within which these individuals behave, and that determines what is reproductively favorable and what is not, and therefore that determines what gets selected. So it's definitely not about, you know, women prefer men because this is going to increase the overall quality of the population of humans. Women prefer particular men and men prefer particular women because that will improve the overall quality of their own offspring. That's how that works. And that's important to keep in mind, because that it's not a trivial distinction. There are situations when you're thinking about what are the selection pressures on mate choice and mating behavior, where distinguishing between what's good for the individual, what will promote an individual's reproductive success, versus what is good for the reproductive success of the entire population. Those two things can become decoupled. Okay. And in fact, with birth rates declining as they are, they're decoupled right now in our society. So that's an important distinction. The second question about, which we'll come back to, I'm sure, but the second question about the dating apps, I'm not quite sure that a couple of things that you said are exactly quite right. So I'm not sure that women being happy about, you know, being happy about the situation on the dating apps is necessarily quite true. To some extent, they are, because there are far more men on these dating apps than there are women on these dating apps. So your friend, Mr. AI generated perfect, is not representative of the male experience on dating apps.
No, certainly not.
That's right. The representative male experience is that they can't get a date in spite of swiping. I will admit now that I don't know which direction you have to swipe to accept or reject, but in spite of swiping in the right direction, a large number of women, they won't actually go on any dates. Whereas women have the opposite experience in a lot of senses, in that women, because they're in very short supply, so there's a huge skewed operational sex ratio in these dating apps. Women are in very short supply. That makes them in high demand. So, of course, women can go on as many dates as they want. But a few people, including a colleague of mine, have done some research looking at the types of people that tend to be on dating apps. And the types of women that tend to be on dating apps are highly neurotic, women with poor self-esteem. And the men that tend to be on these dating apps, your friend excluded, the men that tend to be on these dating apps are also disproportionately manipulative and narcissistic. So dating apps are not necessarily they're not necessarily a happy place, and the people on them are not necessarily happy people, and they're not necessarily there because they're having a good time. Right. So they're not representative, as much as we often bemoan, with some justification, the, you know, sort of electronification of our social lives and the sort of the loss of that organic social interaction. I don't think dating apps actually necessarily encapsulate a nice representative sort of snapshot of the human mating market as it currently stands. I think it's skewed in a lot of ways.
Okay. Do you think the role of dating apps is overstated then? Because, I mean, I'm very old now, but when I kind of look at what these Zoomers are doing, you kind of get the impression it's all dating apps.
I wish I had more concrete up-to-date data to be able to say with more certainty, but I don't think that that is the case. Right. I think it, you know, much like lots of things, like you say, that we see on the influencers on Instagram and the people that do it, they do create this impression of the world. But it's important to remember, especially for probably, I suspect you're a bit like me, spend a little bit too much time in this online world, that it is a something of a bubble. We who live in this online world quite a lot are also not a representative sample of the broader human population. And I think sometimes it's a little bit easy to get caught up in what we're perceiving and assume that that is a pretty good representation of what's going on. I think it's probably not. I still think that, you know, physical interactions are the fundamental basis of relationship formation. And people might meet each other through dating apps, but as, you know, even the story of your friend goes, he finished Tinder, right? So he went through every single person on there and eventually settled down with one of them. So even his story is that, you know, what, of 599 of his 600 experiences did not result in a successful relationship. So I think from his online point of view. Depends on your measure of success. But it's not how I think the majority of healthy, functioning, long-term relationships actually get started. No, okay. I don't think it is.
But I still think there is something about this phenomenon that women seem more willing to share high-quality men than I think men would be the other way around. You know, my 20s were a long time ago now, but, I knew lots of guys who was sort of maintain a rota. And I think the women on it must have known that they were on a rota because, you know, they one of them would only be seen on a Tuesday, for example, and basically get ignored all the other time. And it was kind of amazing to me. I always thought, why don't they challenge this? Why don't they push back? They must know, but they just seem to accept this. And I could never get my head around it. Why is it?
So I think what's happening there is maybe they know, maybe they don't. However, that's kind of a little bit beside the point. So there's this, when you've got short-term mating going on, you've got the male interests and you've got the female interests. Now, both of them could potentially be interested in using this short-term mating arrangement as a springboard to a long-term mating arrangement, because both men and women benefit from long-term pair bonding, raising of children, benefit reproductively. However, men also benefit in ways that women do not from short-term matings while they're single. So once a woman is partnered up, she can benefit from short-term affairs effectively being unfaithful if she can get better genes than what her partner has to offer. But that's a separate situation. If we're talking about people who are single and ostensibly seeking partners, men can benefit from reproductive success just by getting some random woman they're not invested in pregnant. It would be a less than ideal pregnancy, but if it bears a child, that's obviously some reproductive success that doesn't cost him anything. It's just a net bonus, a net gain. Obviously, for the woman involved, that could be detrimental to her lifetime reproductive success if she now has offspring that she is obligated, biologically obligated, to invest in and to rear, and it's going to impact her future prospects of securing a partner and rearing children together. So there are big sex differences in that trade-off. So men are interested in short-term casual sex when they're single. Women are interested in that to some extent, but it's a tug of war game. Men want sex, so you give them a little bit of sex, but then you attach a little bit of commitment to that sex. You try to attach a bit of a price, then you give a little bit more and you take a little bit away. And it's a little bit like a dance, right? It's a game, it's game theory. Men are trying to get one thing, women are trying to get another. And if the woman can keep him around for long enough and have sex with him just often enough to keep him interested, but to hopefully not fall pregnant, if he's not invested, that maybe an emotional bond will form and maybe she can actually nab him. So it's less about these women being happy that they're on a rota and they only get to see him on Tuesdays. And it's even less about whether or not they're necessarily consciously aware of these arrangements, but it's more about a little bit of a give and take. How much can I give? How much can I ask in return? And can I get what I want out of this arrangement?
Are the women consciously aware of this? Or is this all running an autopilot in the background?
So people ask me this question a lot when I explain mating stuff. And I don't know, but I also don't think it really matters very much. So I think to some extent, women, like, just, you know, some women are very naive. Just, I mean, it's not women, right? This is true of people. Some people are very naive. Some people are very savvy. Some women are well aware that on a rota and are very well aware that they're playing a game, but they want him and they're going to play that game and they believe they can win and they believe they can outcompete the other women. Some women are completely, utterly naive, and I'm sure they believe everything he says about working late on every night except Tuesdays. It's largely beside the point whether what women consciously believe or think is going on. They will nevertheless still engage in these types of behaviours and, you know, pursue these men if they think the men are high quality enough and are potentially worth pursuing and they think they have a chance. And they will pick up on whatever cues they can from him of, well, that looks like a cue of commitment, or that looks like it's not a cue of commitment. And at some point, if they decide it's ultimately they're not going to get what they want, then they will ultimately walk. So it's not about them being happy with the current arrangement, or even him necessarily being happy with the current arrangement either. Consciously or unconsciously, it's about what either partner thinks they can get ultimately out of this arrangement. And as long as they think there's a chance they can get what they want, then they'll stay in it in order to get that. How consciously people are aware of this stuff varies, I think, from person to person, and a lot of it is just post hoc rationalization of behavior anyway. Doesn't right. necessarily mean people are conscious of the actual reasons why they're doing this and why they're motivated to do this and why after a certain point in time they become less motivated to do this and less motivated to put up with
okay. it. Okay, so following on that theme, on that theme with conscious versus unconscious behavior, and another question that I've had lurking in the back of my mind since my 20s as well is, and I don't know if you looked at this, but the phenomena of the shit test. And I would often notice that in a new relationship, around about the 1 to 2 month mark, she would feel compelled to pick an enormous fight over something utterly trivial. And after this happened a few times, I then spoke to some mates and said, are you seeing this? And like, yeah, we see that. And I pondered on it. And the best amateur evolutionary psychology bit of work that I could come up with is that, and there was this phrase that came up a lot, will you fight for me? Stuff like that, you know, some variation of that. And I thought, well, if you're a woman who's just gone through the last 4 million years of human evolution, it is a lot better to find out if this man has staying power now than when you're 9 months pregnant and you've got a cyber-toothed tiger up your bum. Did I get it broadly right? I mean, have you looked at shit tests? I mean, what is going on with this whole phenomena?
So broadly, I would say yes. So both partners certainly spend early parts of the relationship signaling their, effectively trying to lure the other partner in. So signaling their own commitment, their own interest, right?
Oh, yeah, because the first month is all sweetness and light. It's after that.
Right, yeah. Exactly. You've got to get this thing off the ground. Yeah. Once you've effectively established, without necessarily consciously speaking about this with each other. Once you've effectively established, I'm interested, you're interested, I know that you're interested, you know that I'm interested, okay, we've got this thing. Now you need to establish just how interested. Now you need to test levels of commitment, because women more so than men to some extent, because men do have resources at stake. However, it's easier, I think, for a man to extract his resources from a burgeoning relationship than it is for a woman to extract her reproductive potential from a burgeoning relationship if she's already pregnant and has a baby and that reproductive potential has become realized. So the risk benefit trade-off is not symmetrical between the sexes. And so, yes, it would be, again, I've seen theory papers on similar types of things. I've not seen empirical data, someone actually trying to test this, but I've certainly seen people mount this basic argument that, yes, picking fights early on is a test of, it's a test of commitment, but it's not just that. It's also a test of how dangerous you are as a mate. So women have, you know, women want, well, women should want to be motivated to pair up with formidable men. Right, you want a man who is going to be strong, who can protect you, and what's often not spoken, but is absolutely true, is can protect your offspring as well. So one of the more lesser known and more interesting observations is that it turns out that if you ask a child sex offender what determines which children they choose as victims, they'll tell you it's the father. If the father is weak or absent, that's a vulnerable child. If the father is strong, they won't go near that child. So you need a formidable man. However, formidable, masculine, aggressive men might also represent a threat to you. So you need a man who can turn that on, but obviously not towards you. So part of picking fights is not just testing whether you go, man, she's hard work, I'm out, although that is obviously useful information to know. But a big part of it is testing what happens if I upset him. Not, and again, this doesn't have to be conscious, but women need to know before they invest too much in a man, what happens if I get him angry? What happens if I'm unreasonable and I upset him and he's got a reason to be upset? Does he control that? Does he, you know, what's he like? You need to know how he's going to fight and whether you're going to be safe. So it certainly makes sense for women to see what happens when, you know, when a new partner gets upset. You need to know what he's going to be like.
So ideally she wants a man that can easily kill her but won't. As simple as that.
Well, I mean, yes, a tad crudely, but yes. Yeah. Ideally you want a man who could kill others, not necessarily you, which I guess by extension means he could, but yes. So that is a very important bit of information for women to have when they're navigating these early parts of relationships and thinking about making long-term commitments. It's especially important for women who are paired up with quite masculine alpha males, if you like. So it may well be that women paired up with men that are more prone to that behavior are going to be more likely to poke the bear a few times just to check what happens before they overcommit.
Yes. I mean, this must make sense. And I kind of go to the point, it must be, you know, running on autopilot in the background because of, you know, obviously millions of years of evolution. And obviously for much of that, life was a lot cheaper than it is now. But that stuff has all been ingrained in for a very long time. But and that kind of makes me wonder, do you find it sometimes difficult to do what you do when so many people have this sort of implicit assumption that 500 years ago we became detached from evolutionary influences and everything is just determined by culture and law these days?
I do find that to be a really intellectually lazy position. And I forgive people that don't have, you know, who aren't schooled in evolutionary theory. I forgive people for having that. I get quite frustrated when I hear that perspective coming from people who ought to know better. So I wrote a little post about this once. I should dig it out somewhere and put it back on my website or something, because this question comes up a lot, and I call it like the escalator fallacy, that people sort of have this assumption that we somehow worked our way up the evolutionary escalator, and when we reached the top, our prize was this great, wonderful, complex culture that miraculously emerged completely divorced and unrelated to our own biology that we then just stepped into and had to contend with, which of course is nonsense. Everything cultural is biological. It's all part of our extended phenotype. It's much more complicated than the extended phenotype of any other species, but that's what it is. And only by looking at it through that lens do I think you can even hope to start to say sensible things about the interplay between biology and culture. Otherwise, I think you're lost.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.